My name is Matt Fulbrook. I am a corporate governance consultant. And while I continue to force you to wait for a new season of 1 Minute Governance and any other new stuff that might come out on the OMG or Ground Up Governance platforms, I figured I'd put out another long-form scripted episode in hopes that I might keep you a bit engaged. And it turns out, incidentally, that people really like these longer episodes. So, I don't know, maybe the whole 1 minute thing is played out. I'm not saying I want to kill the whole 1 minute format, but I will if it's what you want. If you have a strong opinion, let me know. Anyway, this episode involves me trying to figure out why corporate governance consultants mostly suck. My research for this episode started with me wanting to make a general point that people should approach problems with enough self-awareness to realize that they themselves might be part of the problem, or maybe the whole problem. And as usual, I wanted to make a connection to music. I'm writing this sentence on March 7th, 2024. Editorial aside, I know that was a long time ago now. Sorry. On March 7th, 2024, I checked the Billboard Hot 100 list of the week's biggest pop singles because I was hoping it would help me to make my point. And it does help, but to my surprise, it helps in the opposite way than I thought it would. You see, I approached this little bit of evidence gathering with a heaping dose of cynicism and ended up getting a bit of a good news smackdown. So in the end, I proved my own point by being the asshole who fails to see they were the problem all along. Before we go any further, I just want to point out that the title of this episode is Why Do Corporate Governance Consultants Mostly Suck? And not Why Do Most Corporate Governance Consultants Suck? Because I don't really believe the consultants suck. It's just that their work sucks most of the time. I've talked about this in a few ways before, and for the record, my work has sucked too over the years, but I'm trying to get better. The best way I know how to explain the suckiness is that if you take the countless hours, dollars, and tons of cortisol invested in improving the work that boards and executives do together with the help of consultants, the ROI is terrifyingly close to zero. And I mean it. I mean it in terms of tangible ROI, like actual measurable positive change in the way that the work happens, beyond chair shuffling, that is. Don't get me started on how many times I see governance consultants advocating for things like changes in committee structure or board size or whatever without providing any insight into how people are supposed to show up and actually do a good job, as if a structural change on its own is going to be enough to make a board great. Ugh, but more on that later. No. The tangible ROI you'd hope to see is in the quality of work, not in the form of the work. And I don't care how well formulated your governance committee mandate is, it's not going to cause good work to happen. More embarrassingly, I don't think there's much intangible ROI either, as in you spend $100,000 on a governance consultant to do some stuff, a board evaluation, a revision of policies and procedures, some facilitation or coaching or whatever. Most boards and CEOs I know come out of those engagements, and despite the fact that it might have been a pleasing experience, or they may have learned something, or they may have received some interesting insights about stuff, they rarely feel like anything important has changed. They're not like, no, seriously, dude, sure, it was an amazing experience, but more importantly, I totally feel like I know how to do my job better now. Sorry, I don't know why they're from California. By the way, this trend mostly holds true for governance educators and thought leaders too. Lots of talk, lots of time, lots of dollars, little impact. But why? So many whys, actually. On the one hand, why are boards and executives willing to keep throwing their time and money and effort into a black hole? On the other hand, why hasn't anyone come along to disrupt the industry when all the current products and services are value neutral at best? You might be thinking, what approach would have a good ROI? Or even, if everybody's cool with the status quo, it can't be all that bad, right? This brings me to the Billboard Hot 100, or really some snapshots in the history of the Hot 100, also known as snapshots in the lives of all of us who've found ourselves in the embrace of Western popular music for our entire lives. I had an assumption that if I looked at the top 10 songs on the chart today, being the week of March 4th, 2024, it would be a monochromatic mush of overproduced and painfully mainstream pop that would probably be forgotten before the year is out. And I then planned to compare that to decades past and say, look, the top 10 might have always been kind of drivel, but it was better than this. And all that might be true, depending on your taste, but my plan was to emphasize that point by trolling what I assumed would be a pure lack of variety and substance on this week's list, and I was entirely wrong on that front. Here's some other assumptions I made going in. One, at least three or four songs will be insufferable poppy earworms with equally insufferably auto-tuned vocals. Two, probably another three or four hip-hop tracks featuring something in the world of trap beats and that, like, auto-tune or vocoder vocal effect, making the songs sound kind of like they might as well be off an album by Future in 2012 or maybe even Gucci Mane in 2005. Three, somehow another six or seven songs performed by or featuring Taylor Swift. Four, not even a single live instrument anywhere, except maybe some schmaltzy piano ballad perhaps falling into the Taylor Swift and or earworm categories. And that's basically everything I expected. If you're a governance consultant, you can already picture yourself heading into a new engagement with a new client with a ready-made list of assumptions and your preset toolkit at hand to deal with those problems, right? You might be pretending to yourself that your toolkit isn't preset, that all of your work is customized and fit for purpose, but we both know the real truth. It's okay. We'll keep it between you and me. Short interjection here. I'm going to be talking about the details of some specific songs throughout the show. If I had a better understanding of fair dealing and fair use laws, I would excerpt some of the songs for you to hear what I'm hearing. I'm not saying I love most of them, but they still surprised me a bit. I've created a Spotify playlist of all the songs I referred to throughout the episode, and there's a link to the playlist in the show notes. Instead of excerpting them, I've just done a little playing of my own at certain points to illustrate some of what I'm talking about. Apologies in advance for the upcoming quote-unquote slide guitar solo excerpt, which is pretty awful because I don't own a slide, although I do own a full-size pint glass, so that's what I used. Anyway, first off, reports of the death of the guitar and other live instruments have been greatly exaggerated. The number one song, Texas Hold'em, by the incomparable Beyoncé Giselle Knowles Carter, is a country song performed by a black woman which features not only acoustic guitar performed by someone who seems to be uncredited, but also banjo and viola performed by Rhiannon Giddens, and bass and drums performed by the also incomparable Rafael Sadiq. But that's not all. Lose Control by Teddy Swims at number 5 has a guitar solo, something I was convinced was 1,000,000% dead and gone. Beautiful Things by Benson Boone at number 4 is like all guitar all the time. I Remember Everything by Zach Bryan and Casey Musgraves at number 7 is basically only guitar and voice until 3/4 of the way through. Another thing you might notice if you know anything about those artists is that they don't have all that much in common with each other, actually. Yes, the rest of the chart includes a couple of pop earworms, including one of the Taylor Swift persuasion, Cruel Summer, at number 10, and also one, Greedy, by Tate McRae at number 8, that draws on the awful lineage of the equally awful Shape of You by Ed Sheeran, whose 2017 mega hit with its barfy marimba beat launched 500 trillion sound-alike singles that caused a black hole in pop music from which we're obviously still recovering. And yes, there is a song in the trap and auto-tune world, Kanye and Ty Dolla $ign's Carnival at number 2, but that's only 3 out of 10 that completely conform to my assumptions. I was way off. I should also mention that auto-tune in its more subtle form is literally everywhere on the list, but I didn't find it as insufferable as I expected. Just for fun, and because it helps to further my point, let's take a little bit of a dive into one of the tunes. Here are the chords to Teddy Swims' mega hit, Lose Control. F sharp minor, A, D, C sharp sus 4, C sharp 7. It's a strong progression. That's why it comes up in other hits like Unsainted by Slipknot, which is in B minor, and another world-altering mega hit, Crazy, by Gnarls Barkley, which is in C minor. But let's not forget that Gnarls Barkley's Crazy samples and borrows that same chord progression in B-flat minor this time from Last Men Standing by Gianfranco and Gianpero Reverberi, which was part of the soundtrack to the film Django Prepare a Coffin from 1968. In other words, some good things just stay good forever. I promise there's a point here. We'll get there eventually. Anyway, thinking about the top 10, yes, there's more variety and more guitar than I was expecting. Also, there's a significant however in what I'm hearing. And if we take my initial unfounded cynicism and combine it with this however, I think we might have a really useful analogy for why governance consultants' work tends to suck so much. First, let me describe the main contaminant in the river of corporate governance advice. Shit, I already regret this metaphor. I am not very confident I understand how rivers work. Let's see what happens. Here we go. The original pure source of the advice, the trickle from the mountaintops, is a vague but untainted idea of what boards are for. Many governance experts will use terms like independence and oversight and accountability, and other words that none of us could possibly disagree with. Let's think of these concepts as tributaries that feed into the advice river. They may not mean much on their own, but they have the potential to become something powerful, roaring, life-giving, and full of cool critters like giant freshwater stingrays and capybaras and caimans and stuff. Ultimately, our river flows toward the ocean of good governance, a concept so poorly defined that I'm obsessed with trolling the whole world about it. Check out episode 13 of Sound Up Governance for a dissection of my least favorite definitions of good governance. Here's an excerpt from that episode so you can get a sense of exactly how antagonistic I can get about this stuff. Monks and Minow also take a stab at defining good governance thusly.
When corporate governance operates optimally, the three key players, the executives, the board of directors, and the shareholders, provide through a system of checks and balances a system for a transparent and accountable system for promoting objectively determined goals and benchmarks.
Reaction.
Okay, so this is like one of those parts in Beavis and Butthead where Butthead goes, It's like, so first of all, it's an atrocious sentence. I'm sorry, Mr. Monks and Miss Minow. It's really, really poorly written. And also, it's a really, like, this is the reason why I made ground up governance in the first place, is because even the smartest people out there who are trying to tell you what corporate governance is, or good governance in this case, it's always impossible to understand. At the very best, it's something that is barely applicable or barely useful. And in this case, it's just like a perfect example of some really, really smart, really influential, really respected people giving you something that makes absolutely no sense. So, no.
Okay, so we have vague yet pure concepts flowing toward a vague yet contaminated destination. So we need to figure out what happened in between. We know the contamination is there because of the whole massive investment with no ROI thing, right? Like we already talked about. Another way to put it is we know the advice is contaminated because it doesn't work and good governance remains vague and elusive. And I think the best word to describe what's happening along the way is neglect. Sometimes neglect is great, like when I first got a pet tarantula because the breeder explained to me that tarantulas thrive on neglect, and it turned out to be true. Most tarantulas don't need food or water very often and want to be left alone, and in return, they are healthy and fascinating and adorable. Advice, on the other hand, does not thrive on neglect. What do I mean by neglect? Anyone remember the South Park underpants gnomes, which apparently and horrifyingly first appeared in an episode way back in 1998, more than 25 years ago. Holy shit, how is it possible that so much of my life has passed me by? For anyone who has no idea what I'm talking about, there's a South Park character named Tweak whose underpants keep disappearing. Turns out there are little gnomes that go around at night stealing people's underpants out of their drawers. When the South Park gang confront the gnomes about their underpants theft operation, the gnomes explain what they're up to. Step one, collect underpants. Step three, profit. Not only can nobody explain what step two is, it never really occurred to the gnomes to care. That's the flavor of neglect I'm talking about here. And if you've existed in and around the world of boards, you've seen it a million times. I'm almost certain that you've been part of the problem. Let's think of some examples in the form of common governance complaints and, quote, solutions. Board in the weeds? We got you covered. Step one, noses in, fingers out. Step three, good governance. Trouble with board composition and renewal? No sweat. Step one, term and age limits for directors. Step three, good governance. Having trouble getting your directors engaged in fill in the blank? Easy. Step one, 20 questions directors should ask about fill in the blank. Step three, good governance. Think your board might have some room to improve? Bam. Step one, do a board evaluation. Step three, good governance. Feeling like your board agendas are a bit of a drag? This one's simple. Step one, allocate more time to strategy. Step three, good governance. Want to get your executive compensation done right? Obviously, you just got to step one, pay for performance. Step three, good governance. Ultimately, it's all underpants collecting. We go around spending our time and money and other resources collecting underpants because that's what literally everyone else in the corporate governance world tells us to do. But not only do we not do step two or understand what step two is, most of us didn't even realize there was supposed to be a step two in the first place. And that's on top of the fact that most of us can't explain step three beyond just saying the words good governance. And governance consultants, for the most part, seem to be all the way bought into this whole thing. So when their advice doesn't have an impact, well, obviously you just blame the client. Seriously, if you're a governance consultant, do me a favor right now. When was the last time you offered some great recommendations to a client based on a really thorough engagement and the client either didn't follow through on the recommendations or the recommendations didn't lead to any improvement and you took a step back and said to yourself, I must have really messed up here because honestly, if your advice was so great, then your clients would have followed it and it would have worked. Obviously, it's not all the consultant's fault. Regulation, for example, plays a big role in encouraging boards and executives to collect underpants without much concern at all about whether it makes a difference. And a lot of governance research and commentary is really just about underpants collecting. But that's not really any excuse not to try to do better. But this kind of brings us back to the Hot 100, and especially to my mistaken assumptions about it. Not to mention the fact that my mistaken assumptions dramatically increased the risk that I might misjudge the art and artists represented in the top 10. Like, let's take Benson Boone's current mega hit, Beautiful Things. Seriously, it's huge. It has like 350 million streams just on Spotify. Not only does it have guitar, but it has some nice yet simple harmonic variety. There's even a full diminished chord for a second in the chorus. The changes to the first half of the chorus go like this: E flat, B flat, F, F sharp diminished, G minor, E flat, B flat, F. Very pretty. Check it out. Nice use of that F sharp diminished 7 as kind of a substitute for a D7 there. Neat. And not all that common an approach in today's pop music. Except if you rewind 2 years to Benson Boone's even bigger smash, In the Stars, which uses the same trick in the same key and everything. No shade though, I have no issue with someone creating a thing they like and reusing it in different contexts. All good, seriously. So I made an assumption that nothing would surprise me musically in the top 10, and I was wrong. And what I started to say a minute ago is that my general assumptions, like that one, increased the risk that I would judge the art and artists unfairly. For instance, I might see the name of a song, an artist I've never heard, and assume that they're probably not worth my time, just because I don't tend to like today's new music as much as I like the music I obsessed over as a teenager. So, let's do another test. I'm going to make a few statements, and then ask you to privately assess how strongly you agree with them on a scale of 1, being completely disagree, to 10, being completely agree. No middle ground, no half points. You have to fall at least a little on one side of the scale or the other. Here we go. To what extent do you agree with these statements? In general, I believe that new popular music today is less interesting than it was in the past. In general, I believe that current popular music artists are less inspiring than they were in the past. In general, I believe new popular music just doesn't have as much to say as it used to. Finally, in general, I'm less familiar with new popular music than I used to be. If you told me I would get a data set with 1,000 responses to these questions with participants ranging from 12 years old to 100 years old, my guess would be that the average answer to all of the questions would fall somewhere between a 7 and 10, as in pretty strong agreement, except for people under 20 years old whose responses would be much lower. You know, the whole, of course music sucks now compared to what it used to, that's why I don't listen to it nonsense. Here, let's try another one. Without looking, what might you guess the top 10 songs on the Billboard Hot 100 were exactly 30 years ago? The date of the chart was March 5th, 1994. If you actually want to take some guesses, maybe go ahead and pause for a second, jot some notes down. Here's what I might have guessed. Super Unknown by Soundgarden and Downward Spiral by Nine Inch Nails were about to debut at number 1 and number 2, respectively, on the album charts on March 8th, partly on the strength of their lead singles Spoon Man and March of the Pigs, also respectively, which had been out for a couple weeks. Also, can you think of a more bonkers lead single to a smash hit album than March of the Pigs? For what it's worth, Downward Spiral is probably in my, like, top 5 albums of all time. The verse of March of the Pigs repeats 3 bars of 7 and 2 bars of 4, so it feels super janky and weird and amazing. There's also like 7 seconds of basically silence right in the middle of the song, which has a total runtime of under 3 minutes. Silence in a radio single? It's wild. And I love it. Anyway, I would have assumed the chart would include March of the Pigs and Spoon Man, which is also in 7. And maybe a little Gin and Juice by Snoop. How about No Excuses by Alice in Chains? That Jar of Flies EP was huge right then. Maybe Can It All Be So Simple by Wu-Tang, which was their big single at the time. I don't know, something like that. Well, not only were none of those songs in the top 10, despite the fact that the albums were selling like crazy, no, it was way worse than that. Out of the 10 biggest songs that week, 7 were schmaltzy ballads. And I don't mean that as a diss. There were some supreme bangers among them, but 7. Here they are. Power of Love, Celine Dion at number 1. Without You, Never Forget You, Mariah Carey at number 4. Breathe Again, Toni Braxton at number 5. Banger. All for Love, Bryan Adams, Rod Stewart, and Sting at number 6. So Much in Love, All for One at number 7. Now and Forever, Richard Marx at number 8. And Hero, Mariah Carey at number 10. Ugh, make a Spotify playlist of those songs and play it to pump you up at the gym. Ugh. Again, I'm not dissing the songs, but it's just way more than a lot. And filling in the rest, I gotta admit, things don't get much better. At number 9, remember that weird-ass remake of Herbie Hancock's Cantaloupe Island by Us 3 that they called Cantaloupe Flip Fantasia, where it's spelled Canta L-O-O-P because it's got a drum loop? Gag. At number 2, we have double gag, The Sign by Ace of Base. Apropos of nothing, there's a video somewhere of me with my band on the road packed into a van, and I'm reading or reciting the lyrics to Ace of Base's All That She Wants Is Another Baby, and absolutely can't get through it without cracking up. What a weird song. And then saving us finally from the hell that is the rest of our lives, as they've done over and over, is Salt and Peppa with What a Man featuring En Vogue at number 3. So yeah, 1994 was a time of lots of great and diverse music, but the mega hit singles? Just schmaltz on schmaltz. Corn City. And only two guitar solos in All for Love and Now and Forever, both also pretty cheesy. The closest guess I got was that Gin and Juice is there at number 15, and the rest of the top 50 is chock full of sentimentality. Even our incomparable friend Raphael Sadiq is there as one of the Tonys in Tony, Tony, Tony at number 36 with open parentheses, lay your head on my closed parentheses pillow. Have we officially reached the, Matt, shut up point of the episode? Yes? Good. Let's tie this back to governance consultants. Whether you're a deeply experienced CEO or corporate director or governance consultant or educator or whatever, I bet you have powerful, strongly held beliefs about things like, say, board size or board evaluations or how best to discharge a board's fiduciary duty and the appropriateness of shareholder-driven decisions versus stakeholder-driven decisions. Anyway, you have strong opinions about most or all of those things, right? For example, if I asked you, what's more effective, a 10-person board or a 50-person board? You probably don't have to think too hard to give me an answer, and it's probably the 10-person board. Now, indulge me and take a second to ask yourself where your opinion comes from. Let me be clear, I'm not asking you to justify your opinion, rather the opposite. Try for a second to prove to yourself that your opinion is based on something objectively measurable. Matt, you might say, I've read Cowan Cousins' research from 2014 that shows decision accuracy goes down in larger groups. Plus, don't you know about groupthink or social loafing or other phenomena that are more common in large groups? And I might say, OMG, you're right. All those factors matter. So, based on some of the other decision accuracy research, that means all boards should be smaller than 7 people, right? In fact, there couldn't possibly be any reason for decision-making group to be more than 6 people anywhere, if we insist on conforming to the findings of one stream of research, that is. Even if every board being 6 people sounds amazing to you, which it probably doesn't, honestly, I feel like we're being intentionally ignorant. First of all, when it comes to decisions, we're not only concerned with accuracy, right? What if dreaming is an important element of big picture decision making? How many people is the right number to dream as big as possible and consider as many perspectives as possible? And even Cowan Cousins' research suggests that a range of 5 to 20 people might be totally fine. Anyway, what I'm really trying to say is that there's actually no foundation at all for most of the orthodoxy around corporate governance. No matter how strongly you believe in one model or approach or structure or whatever, I can almost guarantee there are justifications to do the opposite, at least sometimes. The Billboard Hot 100 launched in 1958. So if we go back 10 years at a time, the farthest back we can go is 1964. If you had to guess what year was the most wild and diverse, would you choose 1964, 1974, 84, 94, 2004, 2014, 2024? If you were expecting a roughly linear decrease in variety over time, like I kind of was, I encourage you to brace yourself. Based on your hypothesis, the week of March 7th, 1964 should be absolute chaos compared to March 7th, 2024. Well, for better or for worse, we have 3 Beatles songs and mostly a bunch of surf and surf-influenced pop songs. It's a good list, but not particularly adventurous. But why do we, or at least I, assume that the farther back we go, the more complex or interesting or indelible the music will get? Sure, I've read the articles about the death of the bridge in pop music. For instance, there was one called Is TikTok Killing Off the Pop Music Bridge in The Guardian in 2022. I've heard about the decrease in key changes in number one songs, like in the article called The Death of the Key Change in Tedium in 2022. And I love bridges and key changes, even though only 25% of number one songs between the 60s and 90s had key changes, FYI. But mostly, I don't think those changes happened because music got worse. I really appreciated Chris Della Riva's perspective in the second article I just mentioned, that these changes happened in large part because of a wondrous revolution called hip hop. Whether intentional or not, probably completely intentional actually, hip hop bent and broke essentially every pop music convention. By the time hip hop was 20 years old, it was absorbing sounds and inspiration from literally every corner of recorded music history and injecting life into an early 90s world overrun by power ballads. And if injecting that life meant discarding some bridges and key changes, it was worth it. Because 10-ish years after that, we find ourselves in 2004, and that is when the chart is beautifully chaotic and full of songs that have proven to be just as indelible in the mainstream as those Beatles hits from 1964. As in, you could probably listen to any top 40 radio station in the world right now and hear Hey Ya by Outkast or Yeah by Usher like 400 times a day. Does that sound weird to you, hearing me compare Outkast to the Beatles? Hearing me compare Hey Ya to I Wanna Hold Your Hand? Comparing Splash Waterfalls by Ludacris to Fun 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 by the Beach Boys, especially if we're talking about the uncensored version of Splash Waterfalls? Actually, now that I've made that comparison out loud, can I just say that Splash Waterfalls and Fun 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 are both total fucking bops? If there's anyone listening who was born in the last 25 years and doesn't know one or both of those songs, there's your homework assignment. Setting aside for the moment your own musical preferences, any resistance you might be feeling to embracing the fact that new music is probably pretty great is just you hanging on to unfounded orthodoxy. It doesn't make you old or stubborn or ignorant. It makes you normal, and it makes you incorrect, the same way that buying into conventional governance orthodoxy makes you normal and incorrect. There's no incentive, really, for governance consultants to wonder about step two. That's why they mostly suck. Nearly every dollar ever spent on governance consultants led to a recommendation to collect underpants and a promise of profit. Do your board evaluation, get your fingers out, ask your 20 questions, and call it a day. Forget that Anita and Bonnie Pointer wrote Fairy Tale, the amazing and super twang-tastic Pointer Sisters single that went to number 13 on the charts in 1974 and earned them Best Country Vocal Performance by a Duo or Group at the Grammys. It was covered by frickin' Elvis, meaning as trailblazing and amazing as Beyonce is, she wasn't the first or necessarily best. Also, Texas Hold'em, as rad as it is really more like a Lumineers-style pop folk song than country, right? No snark intended, really, just trying to remind myself that the roots of black women in popular country music run deep. Sorry, I got distracted. Corporate governance consultants mostly suck because usually the only innovation they offer is a repackaging of conventional nonsense. It's fine. It's not morally wrong or ethically wrong or even objectively bad. The ROI is just zero. So, what should you do? If you're a governance consultant or educator, start obsessing over step three. Good governance. If you can't describe with confidence and specificity what good governance is and do so in a way that any reasonable person might say, oh, cool, I understand what you're talking about, then you won't even notice that the river is pouring raw sewage into the ocean, right? If you don't know what the ocean is supposed to be like, then you won't notice the contamination. Once you've done that, you should be able to take a governance-related problem like the board being in the weeds and design a sewage-free intervention that leads to actual for real good governance instead of underpants collecting. And if it doesn't work, then you can work with your client to better understand why. If you're a corporate director or senior executive, do the same thing as what I told the consultants to do. But then once you have a confident and specific definition of good governance, ideally one that your fellow directors and executives share, you can then tell any governance consultant that you hire that their work must point you toward good governance and that you'll know the difference. Before we wrap up, it's worth saying that I believe good governance can't be measured based on operational results. In fact, I believe catastrophic failure is an acceptable result of good governance. For more on that, I recently did an episode of the podcast called Good Corporate Governance Does Not Cause Good Corporate Performance. This is me advising you not to define good governance based on results alone. This is not an implicit push for you to embrace my definition of good governance, which is intentionally cultivating effective conditions for making decisions. If you don't like it, that's totally cool. But if you're having trouble coming up with something better, you might find it useful as a starting point. For what it's worth, my two favorite top tens out of the lists we covered is a tie between 1974, which we didn't really talk about, and 2004. Least favorite is a tie between 1994 and 2014, which we also didn't really talk about. How about you? Check them out. Let me know what you think. And for now, that's all I got to say about any of this. My name is Matt Fulbrook. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time. We've reached the time for a post-credits music nerd thing about the song Hey Ya by Outkast, which I never realized had something really strange in it, like staring us right in the face, which is that the guitar chords through the whole song basically go like this. Okay, we all recognize that. Nothing weird there, except for the fact that that last chord, E major, clashes with the chorus. I can't believe I never noticed that. I bet you there's like a lot of you who are musicians probably played this song around the campfire a million times and realized that the hey ya, hey ya, what? They sing the minor third and the chord is a major chord. Really weird. Really weird. Thanks for listening.